Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Endometriosis is a chronic medical condition where uterine tissue grows outside the uterus and often implants on other organs inside the abdomen, causing pain and potential infertility. This condition affects at least 10% of women and 38% of women with infertility. The complex nature of treatments and the challenge of diagnosis leads to endometriosis being underdiagnosed and thus undermanaged. Let's explore the vital intersection of endometriosis and self-advocacy in medicine. Joining us today is Dr. Matthew Lindemann, a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist specializing in minimally invasive surgery. He is the founder of Borealis Life in Anchorage. LIFE is an acronym that stands for Laparoscopic Institute for Fibroids and Endometriosis. He offers a multidisciplinary approach to the treatment of endometriosis, uterine fibroids, and pelvic pain. His approach is centered around the patient. He's passionate about encouraging patient self-advocacy in the medical space. Dr. Lindemann, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jillian. It's great to be here.
Thank you. And you can also join our conversation. Do you experience pain with your menstrual bleeding each month that you believe is out of proportion to what others experience? What misconceptions have you encountered about menstrual health? Or do you have questions about what is considered normal? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Lindemann, your expertise in the field of endometriosis and fibroids and pelvic pain is invaluable. Endometriosis, as we know, is really misunderstood. It's underdiagnosed, undertreated. So I'm eager to understand more and share your journey in medicine with us and your specialized focus in this area.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited to be here and to let people know more about endometriosis. I think it's underappreciated and the significance of it. And a lot of times people are not really encouraged to express how much trouble they're having.
That's right, yeah. Well, let's start with you. And can you share with us your journey and what led you to become an OBGYN?
Yeah, exactly. My dad was an OBGYN, so that's always a little bit.
It's in the family.
Yeah, but he always discouraged me from going into it because you're up at 3 in the morning.
Yes.
It's like there's easier ways to be a doctor. He thought like maybe a radiologist or urologist would be easier. But my goal of going into medicine was, my vision was to be a primary care doctor, continuity of care, that kind of stuff. And I'm from North Dakota, and there's a huge need for that. And the University of North Dakota School of Medicine, where I went, is that's one of their fortes, is graduating doctors that go into primary care. And then my third year of medical school, my first rotation was in surgery, and I just realized I really loved it. And
yes.
I needed to try to incorporate surgical practice into primary care. And there's just not that many fields that you get a chance to do both. OBGYN is kind of unique field that way. And then delivering babies is unique, kind of exciting and rewarding feature. So it all kind of came together into OBGYN.
Right, absolutely. I think that happened with a lot of us. We're like, we definitely want to do the surgery part.
Right.
And then it is very unique.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any other specialty quite like that.
There's not. Yeah, I think it's really nice that you can get to know patients and offer them medical management and other than surgical management, and then transition into surgical management when it's appropriate. And that's really the only field where, because general surgeons don't usually do a lot of medical management.
And
internists don't do any surgery, so.
And you literally follow them throughout life.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. From birth and, until people get older.
The end, yes.
Yeah.
Well, what led to your specialized focus in endometriosis?
Yeah, I had a really nice training in Milwaukee with minimally invasive surgery and laparoscopy. So when I moved to Anchorage, it quickly became a big part of my practice. And so a lot of surgeries that we do with laparoscopy end up being endometriosis surgery. So my practice kind of just evolved in that direction. And then I started just developing a, more of an interest in just getting to talk to my patients about all the trouble they were having, it really became apparent to me that there's a huge need for someone to really focus on this disease. So I had a vision probably 3.5 years ago to kind of establish a more specialty practice. I was able to do that, established Borealis Life in May of this year. I took a special board certification in minimally invasive gynecology and passed that board exam in October of 22, and then established my practice in May. And it's been so rewarding, and I'm just really grateful to have the opportunity to help people with this disease.
And that's unique as well. So you're board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, but also you have this further specialty in minimally invasive surgery. And can you just tell us a bit about what minimally invasive surgery is?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, basically in surgeries that have smaller incisions. So the surgery that's done on the inside is very similar, but it's the excess that's different. And the advantage of that is the recovery is much faster.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And you do robotic surgeries as well as laparoscopic surgeries, right?
Correct, okay. Yeah.
Well, what gaps did you notice in the healthcare system regarding the treatment of endometriosis? And why did you feel like you needed a space that was dedicated to endometriosis and fibroids?
For one thing, I felt like that there's more to treating endometriosis than just treating the endometriosis. There's sequelae and consequences of endometriosis that is not just something that you can take care of with hormones or with surgery. I think it was very important to me to have a coordinated, comprehensive approach utilizing pelvic floor physical therapy and holistic remedies like dietary, nutritional things can be very important, and acupuncture can be important. So, and it works better if we kind of do this all at one time, so we can be treating the endometriosis and then treating the inflammation and treating the pelvic floor spasm. It's better to do it all at one time than sequentially, because by the time you fix one thing, there's something else lingering, and then by the time you fix that, then the other thing has kind of come back. So I think there's a synergy to this when we can do it all together, and I really feel like patients need a place where they can go where they're believed.
That's right.
They don't have to, I believe you.
I believe you have pain.
I believe
we can find a cause.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't have to live like this. And, you know, the acronym of my company is on purpose. Like, we really hope to help people get their life back.
Well, general gynecologists also treat endometriosis. So is that what sets your practice apart, is that you are offering this comprehensive approach that's really specialized on a very particular subset of patients?
Exactly. Yep.
Well, let's get into the basics then. Let's talk about the menstrual cycle. Let's start there and talk about the symptoms that are typical to experience for women during their menstrual cycle, and particularly, of course, those women who are of reproductive age and people
right.
with a uterus of reproductive age.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a little tricky because I think people expect to have some degree of cramping with their period. And so then it's hard to know, like, when does that turn over into something that's actually pathologic. I think really the easiest way to do it is just to believe my patients. If their lives are being negatively affected by their periods, if they're not able to enjoy certain activities, if they have to plan vacations and plan trips around their periods, then, and if they want help to make, you know, to help that be better, then we should be able and willing to do that. So I kind of let the patient decide what they think is normal. The only caveat to that is that a lot of times people are kind of told that having severe pain is normal, right? They don't even, but eventually they realize that they're having dysfunction. So one of the things I want to do is just raise awareness that you don't have to live your life kind of around your period. The period should kind of be in the background.
So if you're missing activities that you would normally be doing, that's something that could be pathologic. And
exactly.
You need to seek some answers for that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're missing school or work or even just other activities, a lot of times people, you know, during their period, they don't want to go fishing, or they don't want to go hiking or snow machining. And then you realize you start to withdraw from your social network a little bit, because there's just so many days per month when you're just not able to or feel, you know, kind of in survival mode. So,
well, tell us about a particular, like a an amount of bleeding that should be considered somewhat normal or somewhat typical.
Exactly.
How do people know if their bleeding is too much?
Yeah, yeah. It's a little bit tricky. It's usually based on, I mean, a lot of it's just dysfunction too. There's people that describe they can't even leave the house. And I know my girlfriend was having trouble with fibroids and bleeding, and she would describe times when she couldn't even leave the bathroom, let alone leave the house. So if there's dysfunction from it, that would be the big thing. But we always say if it's, you know, we kind of measure it in number of soaked products. So if it's more than like 1 hour for a couple hours, then that's kind of an emergency.
Yes.
But it does vary quite a bit, and it's kind of genetic. So people kind of decide based on what their mom's experience has been or the sister's experience has been. But if you're experiencing dysfunction related to how heavy your bleeding is, and having times when things soak through, like, that's not normal.
Yeah, I think that's really important to drive home, is soaking through clothes, you know, soiling your clothes and things is not a normal experience.
Exactly.
And I think maybe sometimes when young people experience their first periods, that can happen, right? Because they're just not prepared with the right things that they need.
Right.
Which I think happens a lot less now, because there's so many things for young people to prepare themselves that maybe weren't available 20 years ago.
More options.
So exactly, more options. The period undergarments are amazing. And then many different sizes of tampons and cups and so many things that they could use.
Yeah, exactly.
So as an older adult, to have that issue where you're messing up clothes is not normal.
Not normal.
So
exactly.
Seek help in that situation.
Exactly.
I guess it's also important to mention that bleeding is different when you're on different hormonal birth control methods too.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think some people may think that a small amount of bleeding or no bleeding is not considered normal, when in some methods it can be.
Right, exactly.
So what are some common misconceptions you've encountered about the menstrual cycle that you feel are maybe important to know?
I think one of the things I found, and a lot of this I've just learned from my patients, because, I mean, I've never had a period, but I've talked to a lot of people that have, so I think that it's important, just kind of what we've already stated, that just if you're having trouble, if you're having dysfunction related to it, even if your mom says, like, oh, that's just normal, because a lot of times this stuff runs in families, so your mom has horrible periods, so then they kind of expect that, you know, that's kind of just your lot in life, and we just have bad periods, and, you know, to get told that something's normal when it's causing you dysfunction can be really dispiriting and hopeless, because you don't really feel like you can function this way, but you're being told by a lot of people, including doctors, that it's normal. So I would just encourage people to trust themselves, and if you feel like it's probably not normal, then you should just seek medical care until you find somebody that will kind of validate your sense.
Right, because your mom may have had signs of endometriosis and may not have been evaluated for that, and just kind of dealt with the issues that it caused throughout life. So this is your chance to kind of find out and dive into it.
Right, exactly.
So can you talk to us a bit about endometriosis? What is it, and what are the symptoms of having it?
Yeah, endometriosis, I think of it as, the word we use in medicine is called ectopic. And ectopic just means an improper location of a proper tissue. So there's something called ectopic pregnancy. Well, people have heard ectopic in terms of pregnancy. It's a pregnancy that's not an abnormal pregnancy. It's just in the wrong location.
Outside the uterus.
Exactly. Yes. So and there's something called ectopic kidney. So you can have your kidneys usually located higher in the back by your ribs, but it can be in your pelvis. So endometriosis is like ectopic endometrium. It's the endometrial cells that normally grow in the lining of the uterus that get inside your abdomen. Usually it's around the ovaries, behind the uterus, in front of the uterus. So they're not necessarily, we're finding that they're probably not exactly the same cells, that there's something different about those cells than for people that don't have endometriosis. the way that we think this mainly happens, how does this tissue get from inside the uterus to outside the uterus? It's called retrograde menstruation, where the cells can actually, the blood can follow through the fallopian tubes and then settle in the abdomen. But it's not just that, because there's reports of people with, after hysterectomy, can have recurrence of endometriosis. So where are those cells coming from?
They're not menstruating anymore, exactly. But they still have those cells.
So those, every cell in our body is pluripotent, as you know. So it's, every cell has the same DNA. They just act differently based on certain parts of the DNA being exposed and producing different proteins. So every cell in our body can turn into
something else.
Exactly. So there's definitely that part of it. I think that most people believe that the biggest reason for that endometrial tissue to be in the abdominal cavity is retrograde menstruation. But then it's curious too, because I think retrograde menstruation is really common. And there's times that we do laparoscopies for something else, and then we see blood in the abdominal cavity.
Yes.
But those people don't necessarily have endometriosis. So why is it that certain endometrial cells, I think most people with the uterus are exposed to blood, endometrial blood in their uterine, in their abdominal cavity, but why do some people develop endometriosis and some people don't? So I think there's a lot of more bench research that we can do to try to figure out what is going on with those cells. And there's people that have, as you know, there's a wide variety of pain related to different amounts of endometriosis. People have one little spot of endometriosis and they're devastated. And some people have a whole bunch of endometriosis and don't have too much trouble. And it's easy to say that that's because some people are tougher than other people. But it's not that. It's really not that. It's the disease behaves differently in different people. And we just haven't done a lot of bench research to help us figure that out. So that's one of the things I would like to do, too, is advocate to have more resources towards research, too. Because I get this sense that not everybody with endometriosis, that their tissue is the same.
Right.
But we don't realize all that. I mean, there are probably receptor differences that we don't really understand. And it makes me think of maybe what breast cancer treatment was like 50 years ago before we knew about estrogen receptors and progesterone receptors and all that, so that we were just offering
therapy.
Exactly. We were just offering like a blanket therapy, and some people responded fantastic and some people didn't respond at all. And we didn't know ahead of time predictively which people are going to respond to which treatment. So I think that there's, it's sad that our society hasn't put the research into this, but it's hopeful that we can make progress, but it just means having the political will.
Absolutely. Well, I want to paint a picture a little more clearly about retrograde menstruation. So when we're thinking about the cells, the lining of the uterus shedding blood, typically it goes from the uterus through the cervix and out through the vagina. But your uterus also has the fallopian tubes attached, and those fallopian tubes exit through the abdomen. So sometimes instead of that blood going through the cervix, it goes backwards through the fallopian tubes and out into the abdomen. And so that's when Dr. Lindemann mentioned that sometimes people can have blood in their abdomen, particularly around that time of their period. It's not a dangerous amount of blood, just a little blood that you may see. And that blood would carry those cells from the lining of the uterus. So that could be sitting around there in the abdomen. And I think for some people, the majority of people, it gets resorbed and goes away, and then you go through your next cycle. But sometimes those cells implant on different things in the abdomen, and then they cause problems, and that's an endometriosis.
Exactly.
And then you were also saying that those cells may be a little different, a little atypical.
Not atypical in terms of cancer or precancer,
right.
Not that type of atypical, but just behave differently than normal.
Yeah, that's important to mention too.
Don't want to alarm anybody.
Right, and yes, we're not talking about cancerous cells.
Right.
And very interesting about the gene therapy, because I think at some point we will get there.
Yes.
And just talking about how genes can be turned on and turned off, and what is it in our environment, right, or in our bodies or toxins that lead to that? And then how can we target those for treatment?
Yep.
Well, how is endometriosis diagnosed? I think that is something that's very difficult. and getting better. So tell us about that.
You know, a lot of this, you know, Jillian, we've talked a lot and we share a lot of, you know, similar ideas, but you understand that a lot of the information we get from patients in terms of what kind of disease or problem, you know, diseases they might be having is based on the history. And we learn in medical school and residency how the patterns of, and you know, presence of different symptoms at different times and how things are related. That's a big part of how we come up with, at least get an idea of a diagnosis. And then sometimes there are confirmatory studies that we can do, like lab tests, and physical exam plays a role in that, and radiologic studies. A lot of it comes from the history, though. Like, so a lot of times people just have like a very similar story. So I think that's a big part of it. If people have severe cramping pain with their period that's causing dysfunction, that is a very high chance that they have endometriosis. Eventually it'll be before and after their period, but it's almost always worse with their period. And a lot of times women describe it as cramping pain. It's not always. You know, there's always outliers and nobody comes in like a walking textbook. So I think that's a really important thing to emphasize to people, that we can get a really good idea of whether someone has endometriosis by just asking a few basic questions and then just believing the people. You know, a lot of times patients will kind of walk you to the right diagnosis if you just listen and believe them. Right. And they might not know that that's the destination. They just know that they're on a journey. But they'll really kind of take you. And then you look around like, okay, here we are. This sounds like endometriosis. The gold standard test is laparoscopy. So that's tough. It's tough to have a disease that the best way to diagnose it.
It's with kind of surgery.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
No specific blood test.
There's not yet. Tough, no, right? I think there are things that are being developed for sure. There's inflammatory markers that we can get that would give us a sense of that, but they're very nonspecific. Like, you know,
no.
Not
that's
really.
What we want.
A binary, yeah. So it's like a high degree of sensitivity and specificity. We don't have anything super great for that yet, but there is potential for that. I think that's one of the things that's be hopeful, and it would be really helpful to patients, because even just realizing that they have a certain disease can help them feel validated.
Okay. Well, I think I want to get into talking about imaging as well. So
right.
Let's do that when we come back from
okay.
The break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Lindemann, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We're just about to take a brief pause, but after the break, we'll dive further into our discussion on endometriosis with Dr. Matt Lindemann. Stay tuned as Line One continues across the state. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by our expert, Dr. Matt Lindemann, a gynecologic surgeon and founder of Borealis Life, a practice that specializes in the treatment of endometriosis, fibroids, and pelvic pain. Call and join our conversation. Have you been diagnosed with endometriosis? Are you aware of treatment options for endometriosis? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, just before the break, you were talking about diagnosis and that surgery is really the gold standard, so the recommended way to diagnose it, which is very difficult. In my practice, I know we do not diagnose it that way in the majority of people. Can you tell me a little bit about imaging and if imaging, like, you know, ultrasound or mm-hmm. CT, because often people want to just take a look and see if they have something. How does that play a role in endometriosis?
Yeah, it's an important, specifically in the evaluation of pelvic pain. There's other things besides endometriosis that can cause pelvic pain, and ultrasound is really the best way to look at gynecologic organs. If you're worried about bowel or bladder, then maybe a CT scan would be helpful. But specifically looking for endometriosis, one of the problems with ultrasound is it's not super sensitive, right? So a really common story is people have painful periods. They go to the doctor. A lot of times they just talk about being on birth control. They get an ultrasound. The ultrasound's negative, And patients kind of get this sense like, well, there's nothing there. That's what the message they hear from patients, from the doctors. It's like, well, we didn't see anything. There's nothing there. And then they start to think like, well, maybe there's this in my head, or, you know, it feels like they're kind of being gaslighted a little bit, or it can feel that way. But I make sure to tell people that I think it's between 10 and 25% or so sensitive, depending on the type of ultrasound. And I've worked with a group here in Anchorage called Advanced Sonograms to help develop an ultrasound that's a little bit more sensitive for endometriosis, looking for it in specific areas. You really can't see the cells until they get into groups enough that like maybe half a centimeter is the smallest you'd be able to see. And sometimes that happens. Like there's a type of cyst that you can get in the ovary called an endometrioma that's very classic appearance. And if you have an endometrioma in your ovary, then you definitely have endometriosis. But most people with endometriosis don't have an endometrioma. You can also have nodules of endometriosis in different areas in the pelvis that if they get large enough, kind of accumulation of endometriosis cells that you can see that on the ultrasound. So it's still an important thing. If you have those nodules, they can definitely, or the endometrioma can definitely clinch the diagnosis, but the absence of seeing anything on abnormal on the ultrasound does not exclude endometriosis at all. It's really a typical thing. A CT scan is not that great for endometriosis. MRI can be really good too, but the problem, MRI is a little more expensive. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily better. It might be better than the kind of an average ultrasound, but I don't think it's necessarily a lot better than a really good ultrasound.
That's right. That's right. So if someone has perhaps had these imaging studies and they haven't really pointed towards anything, but they have these symptoms of endometriosis that are pretty classic,
right,
what's the next step? Do we go on to treatment or do we look further and do a surgery? What do you do in your practice?
It kind of depends on how much dysfunction patients have and kind of how frustrated they are. We really try not to just jump to surgery. Really, just in general, you know, I talked earlier about as an OBGYN, you get the advantages. You can use medical management and that kind of ultimately lead to surgery. Sometimes my contact with patients is later in the process and they're really despondent. And they're really having a lot of dysfunction. And then they're almost like desperate for something to be done. So sometimes they just need to have a surgery to, because it's probably the most, they're going to get the best, they're going to get better more quickly with a surgery than medical management. That stuff needs a little bit more time. And then sometimes they just feel better, people just feel better having a diagnosis.
Yes.
Right. But typically you'd start off with medical management.
Okay, medical management. Well, I want to hear more about medical management, but I would like to take a caller that we have. So we have Jill from Cantwell that's here with us. Welcome to Line 1, Jill.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Diva. So I had a comment for Dr. Lindemann. I feel like I'm a survivor of endometriosis. I had it for many years and finally, about 12 years ago, I was given a total hysterectomy, but I had lesions, you know, all over my organs. And, you know, I felt your comment really strongly when you said that, you know, you need to listen and believe patients when they tell you that they're having troubles. And anecdotally, you know, after my surgery, I stopped having high blood pressure, and mm-hmm. I had been treated for that previously. And then post-op, I didn't need that treatment anymore, and I think it's really important that women are listened to and given, you know, the I'm so glad that you're doing this research because I'm hoping it helps younger women than myself who have been down this road. And anyway, I'm so excited that you're doing this research, and I'm so glad somebody's listening.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. A really good story about how you're treated for one thing, but everything is kind of connected, you know? And so issues that we're having that we think may be isolated are not.
Yeah. I think that there's a big factor of endometriosis is the inflammation that's caused, because your body knows that those cells are not supposed to be there. So it creates an inflammatory reaction in your pelvis that I think it can get into your blood too. It can affect other parts of your body. I think there's a, you know, think of all these areas of study that are exciting of potentially using anti-inflammatory types of medications for endometriosis. So what I've thought about more recently is working with people like the rheumatologists that help people with autoimmune disorders. And there's mm-hmm. features of endometriosis that are very similar to, it's not classified right now as an autoimmune disorder. I don't want people to get the misimpression that I'm saying that it is, but there are features of endometriosis that are similar to other autoimmune disorders. And we know that inflammation plays a really strong role in the trouble that people have from endometriosis. So I'm just curious, like, well, what if we treated, how about the people that have another autoimmune disorder, if we could ask them about their periods before they start their therapy? Not that we're using the therapy to treat the endometriosis, yes. but when they're being treated for, you know, Sjogren's or lupus or another autoimmune disorder, does it happen to improve? You know, we can just do an observational study that I think would be not too difficult. We just have to get one of the rheumatology clinics to ask people about their periods. So we're in the process of setting something like that up, and I'm super excited about the possibility of that.
Right, absolutely. Have you been seeing that people diagnosed with endometriosis have had other autoimmune conditions?
Definitely. There seems to be a strong overlap between endometriosis and various autoimmune disorders, whether it be rheumatoid arthritis or Sjogren's or lupus, or definitely there's a strong correlation. So it definitely makes you think, like, well, is it a coincidence or is there something, you know, more causative or something that not that one leads to the other, but something behind there that leads to them both?
And there's a lot more attention being played now to inflammation.
Yeah.
Specifically the role of inflammation in so many different pathologies. So in cardiovascular disease,
right.
in weight gain and obesity,
yep.
in hypertension.
Yep.
So
yeah.
absolutely, I feel like there's a role for treatment for inflammation
right.
in this too.
And I think it's really exciting too, because I think that's a mechanism that the holistic therapies can really be helpful, because there's a lot of natural remedies that are good at decreasing inflammation. And I think there's a lot of more study that we can do with natural remedies, holistic remedies, that can really be helpful for not necessarily be the only thing to treat endometriosis with, but could be an adjunctive part of the treatment.
Okay. Well, that made it more clear too with using the multidisciplinary
mm-hmm,
approach,
exactly.
but using them all together or using specific things together. Well, let's get into the medication treatments that are typically used for endometriosis.
Yeah. The standard thing is birth control pills and the way or different types of hormonal contraception. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that they kind of work similarly. Some work a little better than others for different people. It's hard to know prospectively who's going to respond better to Nexplanon versus combined OCPs versus progesterone-only OCPs. But a lot of times we pick one versus another based on people's side effects too. So it's not that one would work better than another, but there's just different side effect profiles of those different methods. But the way that it makes sense that it works to me is that estrogen causes endometriosis to grow. We know that. And that when you're on a hormonal contraceptive, it stops ovulation. When you ovulate, you make a lot of estrogen. So when you don't ovulate, you make less. And it might be confusing to people, like, why are you giving me medication that
yes.
has estrogen to treat a disease that is worsened by estrogen? But that's the way it works. Your overall level of estrogen is much lower with the birth control pill, with the combined birth control pills. So those are the standard things that often people are offered first. They have generally have fewer side effects and have other that it helps treat acne and, you know, functions as contraception. So there's other benefits of birth control. So then there's the Mirena IUD, which can be helpful or different progesterone
IUDs.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So estrogen and progesterone are kind of like yin and yang. So progesterone will help decrease the proliferation of endometriosis and endometrial cells, where estrogen will cause that to grow. So these IUDs, which is a device that's inserted into the uterus, there's progesterone embedded into the IUD and is locally secreted into the uterus and the tissue surrounding the uterus. So it doesn't affect ovulation. So it doesn't affect your overall level of estrogen, but it can topically treat directly
those cells within the uterus
or near the uterus, mm-hmm. right? Exactly. Yeah. So, and you can do both. You don't have to do just do one or the other. You can do combined birth control pills and a progesterone IUD. And there's other medications. There's a hormone called Norethindrone that is often, it's a progesterone that's used in birth control pills quite a bit, but can also be used by itself in a higher dose that will, it does make it difficult to ovulate, but it's not necessarily approved that, you know, approved that to be used that way by the FDA for contraception, but it definitely has a direct effect on the endometrial cells, the ectopic endometrial endometriosis cells. So it can work a little bit differently than the contraception. And then, of course, there's the GnRH antagonists. So you're ready to...
I was going to say about the birth control is I just don't like the term.
I know.
You know, and
right.
I think it actually decreases compliance when we tell people they need birth control, especially if, for one, they don't believe in birth control,
right.
or two, they just don't want to use it because they're not trying to necessarily prevent pregnancy if their
right.
partner had a vasectomy or they're not sexually active.
Yep.
And so I think a lot of people have stopped using mm-hmm. birth control because they felt like they didn't need it.
Right.
And then also you did explain that it's not increasing your estrogen levels. So I think the education aspect of understanding endometriosis and understanding medications is so important. Because if you're thinking that this doctor's giving you estrogen when they told you you can't, you know, you shouldn't have estrogen, that's a problem. So I think you made that very clear that the birth control actually gives you lower levels. It just keeps you from cycling and increasing and decreasing throughout the month like you would normally do in your typical cycle and keeps your levels overall low. So maybe as a whole, we need to change the term and maybe just call it hormonal medications that could be used as birth control.
Right, right, because it's not even the only FDA-approved use of
mm-hmm.
a lot of these medications, right? So why are we singling out the one FDA-approved
right.
usefulness of it and labeling that way?
Right.
It would help us to not, like, I have this conversation a lot. I'll say, like, well, we should try some birth control, and they'll say, oh, or, you know, combined oral contraceptives. Even that has the word contraceptive
yes.
in it, right? And people will say things like, oh, I had my tubes tied, so I don't need it. And then you explain, like, well, we're not using it for the method that's the descriptor.
Right, right.
Right? So it would help us and patients understand, right, that if we had a different term for it. That, what do you propose?
I think just hormonal medication.
Okay. Yeah.
In this situation, hormonal medication to treat endometriosis.
Yeah.
We'll talk about
yeah.
it.
Okay.
We'll
we can figure it out.
Right. Because I've had patients that have had surgery specifically to remove endometriosis. And after surgery, they may have been put onto birth control and they've stopped the birth control because they weren't active and they didn't need it. And then, you know, several years later, they're coming back with the same problems because there was nothing to prevent it from happening again. And so that just needs to be understood. And I think there, you know, needs to be maybe a little more education when we're helping people with endometriosis.
And I think that it's really important to get to know our patients and their fears and their concerns. And if we spend a little bit less time talking and a little bit more time listening, then we might realize, you know, that they're concerned, they're worried about a certain that, well, they might not say that unless you make yourself really available to hear that. Say, well, why are you giving me the estrogen when it makes things worse? They might not, if you don't make yourself open to that information or not aware of that. So a big part of it is, you know, our approach to giving patients space to express their own fears and concerns, and that we can't cut them off. We need to really validate their concerns. Because some people tell you, something that's a vulnerability and you don't really take it gracefully, then they're going to stop doing that.
Right. And you were just about to tell us about the other treatment options. So there are some
right.
GnRH agonists, so some non-birth
yep.
control treatment options. Tell
yeah.
us about
okay.
that.
Okay. So, yeah, GnRH is gonadotropin-releasing hormone. It's secreted by the hypothalamus that just causes a cascade of hormones that will result in ovulation and the production of estrogen and progesterone. So we learned many years ago that there's a way to kind of decrease the production of GnRH, and there's a medication called Lupron, which is an old medication, which I think originally was approved to be used for prostate cancer, treatment of prostate cancer, and then had developed the indication for endometriosis. The problem with that particular medication is it's a long-acting injection. And basically, the medicines kind of put you into temporary menopause. The Lupron can be used up to 6 months, but it was a three-month injection. So if you have side effects from it, that can be a long time. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So more recently, they've developed some other medications that actually work a little bit differently, but have the same effect on the GnRH production.
And they're oral.
They're oral, right?
So that makes it easier.
A shorter half-life, that they're having side effects, they can stop it, and they can, and they're approved for 2 years, which is much nicer than the 6 months that the Lupron was approved.
Right, because after 6 months, then where are we?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And with these medications, are we seeing that they are decreasing the implants for endometriosis, or they're really just preventing? So are they both preventing and also treating once you have the implants?
I think that they probably cause some regression of the endometriosis. I think of the other types of hormonal treatments like we talked about as kind of just preventing it from getting worse, but not necessarily causing things to regress. But I think that these other medications are a little stronger and can actually cause regression of the disease.
Okay. Well, we have about 1 minute to take a caller. We have Donna from Eagle River that has a story about a condition that looked like endometriosis. Welcome to Line 1, Donna.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, hi.
Hi. When my last kid was born in 94, they did a tubal ligation while they were in there. It was basically cut a piece of the tube out. And after that, I would get my cycles, a heavy cycles, like for 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And I got divorced. I didn't want to go on birth control or anything like that. But anyway, the bottom line is it kept getting worse and worse. And other fluids were coming through, and they could not figure out why I was having all this stuff flushing through my system. And eventually in 2008, I was getting septic. I could feel it. I was getting sweaty and hot and shaking. Terrible, terrible pains in my stomach. I had pains before that. They did it ultrasound, all kinds of stuff. Couldn't figure it out. So they went in, died, and it had walled itself off, and eventually it burst, like a burst appendix, which is kind of bizarre.
Miss Donna, but, did you say there was an abscess? We couldn't hear that part.
It had walled itself off. It had died, basically. My ovary had died.
Oh.
It had walled itself off. It was a bag of pus.
Oh.
It had been fighting itself, I guess, for a long time. And it was a sterile abscess. There was no germs ever, you know, made from it. But they did put me on antibiotics for a couple of weeks. And what's interesting is before that all happened, I had a high ANA antibodies, which is indicative of autoimmune disease. But after this happened, I didn't have those high antibodies any longer. They went away. I don't know if there was a correlation. You were talking about
right.
that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But I just found, you know, why would my ovary dying cause the cycles to be so messed up, bleeding so much? And that's one question I have. But it was kind of serious. I almost died, like I said, but they cleaned it all up, and I'm still here to tell the story.
Well, thank you for calling in with that. I think you brought in a lot of points there. And we will give Dr. Lindemann just a few seconds to give his comments.
It's a little hard to know, you know, without looking at your records exactly what was going on. It sounds like maybe it could have been something called torsion, where the ovary twists on itself and can die. It's a little tricky to know for sure what was going on. I'm sure glad that Donna's doing well.
This is a surgical emergency.
Yeah.
It certainly can lead to that infection and everything.
Yeah, very bad pain.
But she drove home the point about inflammation, right?
Yes.
And so she probably had been dealing with inflammation for quite some time.
It probably was like a chronic torsion that was kind of intermittent and then eventually twisted all the way and caused the more acute situation.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be able to talk to you a little bit more after this next break. We're approaching a brief intermission for our stations. For any questions or comments you have for Dr. Lindemann, please reach us statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. Stay with us and we'll resume our conversation about endometriosis. You're tuned in to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our expert today is Dr. Matt Lindemann, who is a gynecologist and minimally invasive surgeon specializing in the care of endometriosis, fibroids, and pelvic pain. You can also join our conversation. What strategies have you found effective in advocating for yourself in the healthcare system? Have you faced challenges in getting the right care or treatment for endometriosis? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So that was a really interesting call that we had about how things can look like other things. Right. And so really just the power of listening and advocating for yourself in the healthcare space. I think a question that people will want to have answered is there a cure for endometriosis?
Is my mic on?
I think you keep going.
Okay, there we go. Yeah. Not really. Mm-hmm. Even a hysterectomy is not necessarily a cure. Menopause.
So the absence of the hormones.
Exactly.
And the absence of ovulation.
Right.
Can be the cure.
It's almost definitively that people will feel better after menopause. But yeah, I counsel my patients that we consider it to be a chronic disease. We can control it. It's chronic but controllable. And I like to give my patients things that they can do to be empowered so that they're not just at the mercy of the endometriosis. There's things they can do in their lives to decrease, you know, the endometriosis and decrease their symptoms.
What does long-term management look like?
It really varies, I think. Some people respond in different ways. Some people respond great just with hormonal treatments, and they just are on hormonal treatments through their majority of their reproductive lives, and they don't need anything else than that. Some people end up having surgery and then feel better for the rest of their life. Some people have surgery and then they feel better for a year and then they start to have pain again. So I find that it's a wide variety of courses. So it makes me think that there's just different subtypes of endometriosis that are behaving in these different ways. And if we had more information, then we would be able to tailor treatments. You know, if we knew ahead of time which patients are going to respond better into different treatments, then we can tailor our treatments prospectively that way instead of this kind of shotgun approach where we just kind of try stuff.
Right. Try, see if it works, try something else.
Yeah. It's frustrating for patients. It's frustrating for doctors.
Yes, absolutely. Right? And, you know, I think we can get there. They're getting there in other arenas, like in pain management and knowing which pain medications work for specific people. Yep. So I think at some point we'll get there.
I think so, too.
Well, Dr. Lindemann, we have another caller. We have Dorothea from Anchorage. Hello. Welcome to Line One.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Sure. I'm very happy that you're doing this program. I had I wanted to share my experience about advocating for myself. I had endometrial tissue that resulted in my having repeated pneumothorax beginning in my late 20s. I'm 70 years old now. Beginning in my late 20s, I had about a half a dozen pneumothorax, even though I didn't fit the profile for that. Yeah. And never once did my gynecologist diagnose me with endometriosis. It was only when a GP referred me to a pulmonologist who happened to know about a type of lung disorder, and it was called catamenial pneumothorax, which is caused by endometrial tissue traveling to the lung and causing lesions. There is a doctor in town who knew all about it, and it was only then that I learned that I had an endometriosis. And that it was endometrial tissue doing this, So I had surgery. I had a thoracotomy to fix my lung in my early 50s. In the meantime, I had gone to three different doctors before this, gynecologists who just didn't know, you know, I was having a lot of endometrial pain, in particular severe back pain. And I surmised, based on just keeping a journal and making the connection between my periods and the onset of symptoms, where I was debilitated for about 24 hours with back pain. I couldn't get out of bed. And then I had to be my own advocate, keep a medical journal. These three doctors just recommended just get a hysterectomy. But by then I was already in my 50s and I wasn't, didn't feel like I needed to. And I was advised by another doctor, an older doctor who had many years experience, who said, no, you're almost at menopause, I wouldn't do it. I think it's really important, if you're not getting the answers that you want or not getting the answers, that you advocate for yourself and go to another doctor. I was interested to learn that the cells can be a different type of cell. But I just felt like a lot of the physicians I was seeing just really didn't know much about endometriosis.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
So,
yes, thank you for sharing that. I think you bring up a point that you share with Dr. Lindemann about advocacy for yourself. And if somebody doesn't know or doesn't seem to give you answers, then you have to keep looking. You did have a very rare situation. And I will say the uterus is extremely powerful, because I remember in residency that we had fibroids that appeared on the lungs. So, and that was the first time I had experienced that. So this is very, very unique. But all the same, when you're having this dysfunction and pain, you need to seek answers. And if you're not getting them from one person, even if they're a specialist, you go to another person. What do you think, Dr. Lindemann?
I 100% agree. Dr. Woodruff is right. The endometriosis in the chest is extremely rare. I've never had a patient have that. You learn about it, you read about it. I have a patient now that is a little concerned about that, so we're having her go to see a thoracic surgeon and hopefully get some more answers. She definitely has a history of endometriosis, and I've helped her with that for a long time, and now she's having more thoracic pain, so we're going to get that figured out. I think any time you have any pain, because you were talking about that your pain was in your back. Mm-hmm. That if there's any pain that's worse with your period, it has to raise suspicion for endometriosis or something gynecologic, right?
Right, right. Well, what are the risks associated with untreated endometriosis?
Pain, obviously. You can get scar tissue. And you can get infertility is a big, or I like to call it subfertility versus infertility. Infertility is so kind of draconian. Mm. I think that it makes it harder to get pregnant. But most women, people with endometriosis, are able to get pregnant, but it does make it harder. And for some people, they're not able to get pregnant. But I want to encourage the audience that even in the presence of endometriosis, most people actually are able to get pregnant. And I would never tell someone, oh, you have endometriosis, you can never get pregnant. It can cause painful intercourse a lot of times.
Yes.
So
when you're using this approach in your office and you're using these other modalities, mm-hmm. are these other modalities to help with pain or mm-hmm. to help with prevention, or, what is the main focus?
Yeah, kind of all of that, right? I mean, I think of my main job is to address the endometriosis itself. Mm-hmm. Like, how can we get these cells to regress or to be less active? Because there's some pain that's mediated just by the presence of endometrial cells. But there's other pain that's kind of a sequelae from that. So there's muscles in the floor of your pelvis called the pelvic floor muscles that can be in spasm because of the inflammation, and we can address that. I don't do that. There's pain specialists mm-hmm. That can address that, and that can be very helpful. There's also pelvic floor physical therapists that can be very good at helping with that kind of thing. In terms of the inflammation, the dietary inflammatory and nutritional things,
yes,
that can
lifestyle management.
Exactly. That can be helpful in decreasing the endometrial cells to a degree, but also in decreasing the inflammation that's resulting from the endometrial cells. So they can work in two different ways. So it just makes sense to me that they should just all be used in combination.
Right. And I think many people do want to know what they can do. What
right.
changes can they make? More holistic approach to treatment of endometriosis.
Just having a chronic disease can be very disempowering. And you feel like you're at the mercy and you lose control. And it can just kind of derail your life when you're feeling, it makes you feel hopeless and despondent. So I think it can be really helpful to give people, you know, tools that they can use themselves to help themselves be better.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. We've had a great conversation, but we're out of time today. Dr. Lindemann, your insights have been so enlightening. Thank you to our expert, Dr. Matt Lindemann, for being with us today. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.